Today's reading is from 1 Samuel. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat beside the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. She was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. She made this vow, "O Lord of hosts, if only you will look on the misery of your servant and remember me and not forget your servant, but will give to your servant a male child, then I will set him before you as a Nazirite until the day of his death. He shall drink neither wine nor intoxicants, and no razor shall touch his head." As she continued praying before the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was praying silently. Only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Therefore, Eli thought she was drunk. So Eli said to her, "How long will you make a drunken spectacle of yourself? Put away your wine." But Hannah answered, "No, my lord. I am a woman deeply troubled. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have been pouring out my soul before the Lord. Do not regard your servant as a worthless woman, for I have been speaking out of my great anxiety and vexation all this time." Then Eli answered, "Go in peace. The God of Israel grant the petition you have made to him." And she said, "Let your servant find favor in your sight." Then the woman went to her quarters, ate and drank with her husband, and her countenance was sad no longer. They rose early in the morning and worshiped before the Lord. Then they went back to their house at Ramah. Elkanah knew his wife Hannah, and the Lord remembered her. In due time, Hannah conceived and bore a son. She named him Samuel, for she said, "I have asked him of the Lord." The word of God for the people of God.
So today we begin our travels to the little village of Ober, Ammergau, Germany. About a year and a half ago, I was asked by the publishing house if I would help them with a project they were doing with Educational Opportunities, which is a travel company, works mainly with the United Methodist Church, getting ready for this next season of the Passion Play. They wanted a resource that churches could use during the season of Lent. It would also come with a DVD for small groups, and the product of that is this little book, The Passion Play, Living the Story of Christ's Last Days. And we have this in our bookstore. Our small groups here in the church are using it. If you're not already in a small group, you can sign up for one today. Stop by the table in the West Passage, because this is the week that the groups get underway. I'm also leading a discussion on Wednesdays in the Great Hall for people sitting at tables, and each table will be like a small group. So if you're not in one already, I invite you to come on Tuesdays. Next Sunday, we'll do a book signing in between the services, and I'll be available out in the gathering area, so I can help take the value of your book from about $10 down to $5 if you'd like to get it signed next Sunday. So I also invite you to take out your outline for the message that, as you'll see, does not have the typical outline. It's just notes, a blank page to take notes, because I don't want to add more to the outline in the first chapter of the book, but I encourage you to take notes, because not everything said in the sermons will be in the material in the book. So you're going to hear fresh things in the sermons as well each Sunday. So the series for Lent is based on the passion of Christ as told through the experience of Ober-Ammergau. As you heard in our call to worship, this tradition of putting on a passion play on the first year of each decade goes all the way back to the 1600s. And this village of 5,000 people in the Alpine Mountains of Ober-Ammergau, Germany, between the months of May and October, will welcome over 500,000 visitors from around the world who will come to see this play. They'll put on over 100 performances. Each performance is 6 hours, and it's spoken in German. For those of you who are going with Bob Zehr on the trip this summer, be ready, 6 hours of German. Hopefully you can still follow the story pretty well. It goes for 3 hours in the afternoon, a 3-hour meal break, and then the second half in the evening. Now think about this, a town of 5,000, how do they feed 5,000 people? It's not just the restaurants. Just about every home has to open their home to the guest in order to feed them in the evening. Why do they do this? Why does this town, every 10 years, go to so much trouble to put on this play? In fact, just repeat that question after me. Why do they do this? I am so glad you asked this morning. I've been waiting to answer that question. It all started with a vow. It started with a vow. The year was 1633, and it was a time of panic all throughout Europe because a deadly plague was killing people at a high rate. It's interesting that we are doing this series during this outbreak of the coronavirus. I mean, we understand what it's like to be afraid and to even panic at the news. If you're not aware, the stock market had interesting things happen this week. We get what it's like to ask the question, what do we have to do to protect ourselves? The elders of the town in 1633 in Oberammergau met to come up with an answer to that question. They're in a remote location in the mountains, so that helped, but they also had a wall that went around the whole village. So they said, we're going to quarantine ourselves. Nobody in or out except for those who must go out to farm their fields, but they have to come back in through the main gate. So we limit our town to just the people who live here. It was foolproof, except one member of the town had been working in another town. He came back home for an annual festival that he did not want to miss. The legend has it that he bribed the guard at the gate, probably a friend of his, and he said something no doubt like, come on, do I look sick to you? Believe me, if I was sick, I would know it. I would tell you, let me in. Kind of reminds us how sin works. None of us are fully aware of what lurks inside of us. Within days, he was dead. Within a few days after that, his whole family was dead. And the precautions of Oberammergau were useless. Within 7 months, 84 members, somewhere between 10 and 20% of the whole village, had died. The people called for a prayer meeting in the church in front of the crucifix that you can still see today. Those of us who are going to Oberammergau will get to go in the church and see the same crucifix where they pledged themselves to God. They made a vow before God. In fact, you'll see the words on the screen. Join with me as we say this vow out loud. Every 10 years, the devout representation of the sufferings and death of Christ should be given so that God would have mercy and free our village from the appalling sickness. That was exactly what the people said. And since that time, they started the very next year, 1634, they put on their first passion play, and they did it on a stage next to the church over the graves of the 84 people who had died. They've been doing it ever since. I got to be there on the day that they announced the cast for this upcoming season, October of 2018. That's how far back they do it. It's the most important day of the decade. Every year and a half before the next season of plays begins, they have this day as a town when they announce the cast. Imagine little children growing up wondering, might I be picked one day? Might I get a big part? Might I be the one who gets to be Jesus? Next week, I'll tell you about standing right beside the guy who is going to be Jesus this season, seeing his name written on the board. So it's a really big day in the life of this town. And as I stood there that day, I realized I am in a community of people who have become defined by an ancient vow. This vow has defined who they are. How has your life been defined by vows? What are the vows that have shaped you? Vows your parents made? Vows you made to God? Vows you made to other people? Part of the power of a vow is the way it shapes us and changes our path. That's the significance of the story that we just heard from 1 Samuel. It's a story about the change of history of Israel. Following the years in which they wandered in the wilderness under Moses, they entered the promised land under Joshua. For 200 years, the people lived in tribes all over the nation, but they were not a unified nation. They had no unified government. They did not have a king. Soon, they would have a king. They would be a unified nation. But this story is the hinge between those two periods of history, and it came down to a vow that was made. Hannah, the wife of Elkanah, who also happens to have another wife. She's had children with her husband, but Hannah has not been able to have children. She's barren, and it is a source of great grief in her life. And one day, they go as a family to the temple, and the other wife makes fun of her that she can't have children. They're around all kinds of families who have their children coming to give thanks to God for their blessings. And getting close to the temple is this source of grief for Hannah. Have you ever found it hard to worship when you're in a time of pain? Have you ever found that when you get close to God, it makes you that much more aware of your grief? This past Wednesday, after the evening Ash Wednesday service, a woman came out in tears and explained that last Sunday she watched our service online. She heard the sermon by Rudy Rasmus, the guest preacher who was here. She said when he said that date, August 14, 2017, and told how he was thinking about taking his life, I was frozen. That was the day my sister took her life. Sometimes getting close to God makes our pain and our hurt feel even more intense. But God never makes us aware of our hurt without wanting to do something about it or something with it. God never makes us aware of hurt without wanting to do something about our pain or something with our pain. That's what Hannah did. Instead of letting her pain become a wedge between herself and God, she let her pain take her to God. She prayed a vow. Look at the words that she prayed. Lord Almighty, if you will only look on your servant's misery and remember me and not forget your servant but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord. Notice a couple qualities about that prayer. It is to the Lord. That's what a vow is. That's what makes a vow different from an oath. An oath is an agreement between people. A vow brings God into the agreement. The other thing to notice about this vow is the if-then quality of it. If you will give me a son, she says, then I will devote him to you. Some people say that sounds more like a bargain than a vow. It's bargaining with God. God, if you'll do this, then I'll do this. It's conditional. That's what the people in Ober-Ammergau prayed. If you'll spare us any more deaths, then we will be faithful. Is it a bargain? This raises an observation about the Ober-Ammergau vow that's been kind of hard to figure out. It has to do with the dates. The record of deaths in the town happened between November of 1632 and July of 1633. 7 months, over 80 people died. That's roughly 3 deaths a week, a little more than. The date associated with the vow in the church was in October of 1633. Now think about this for a moment. The vow is asking God to bring an end to the deaths, and it's 3 months after the last recorded death. That doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? I believe that the vow made in October was not the first prayer meeting of the people. I believe the original vow wasn't recorded, but it happened in July. It happened toward the end of the deaths when they were desperate. And they said, God, if you will do this, if you'll bring an end to the deaths, we will put on this passion play. And can't you imagine somebody 3 months later calling some people together and going, hey, wait a minute, think about this now. We haven't had a death since the night that we made that promise. And people probably started thinking, going, you know, you're right. No one's gotten sick. There haven't been any more signs of the plague. And this person going, okay, we've got to come through on our end now. Have you ever made a promise to God? And once the crisis was averted, you tend to forget the promise. It's like the guy driving around the parking lot. He can't find a parking space. He prays a little prayer. God, if you will give me a parking space, I'll start going to church every Sunday. And right then, somebody backs out of a parking space at the very front. He whips the car in there, and then he says, oh, don't worry about it, God. I got it taken care of. How easy is it when we get what we need to forget about the promises? But the truth is, something like that is not a vow. It's not a vow. Why? Because we're getting something we are capable of getting ourselves. We're receiving something we don't really need any help with. A vow is different. A vow puts ourselves in the hands of God, where if God does not come through, we don't have anything. When you make a bargain, you're bringing something to the table. You have something somebody else needs or wants, and they've got something you need or want. That's a bargain, right? Hannah didn't have anything to bargain with. She had no children. The people in Oberammergau didn't have anything to bargain with. They were dying. Their vow was what they would do with God's blessing if God blessed them. It was a future statement of faithfulness. God, you do this in my life. I promise you. I know a guy named Royce Reynolds. He's earned a lot of money in his life selling cars, but he's given a lot of money away, tens of millions of dollars, in fact, to his church, to his annual conference, to Salvation Army, to various missions. And if you ask him, what has prompted you to give like that? He will say it was a vow he made when he was a teenager. He was dirt poor, walking down a road in Alabama, and he said, God, if you will get me out of poverty, if you'll help me to one day own my own house and be able to feed my family, I promise you today, I will give you 1/10 of every dime I ever make. And he has. That's the power of a vow. To live up to a promise of what God will do when God comes through, and to trust in that. A vow like that calls forth something inside of us. It summons the best in us. It gives us something to live up to. You remember that scene from the movie Lord of the Ring, the very first part of the series? Frodo has this group of people who are going to help him on his mission to destroy this ring, but he realizes he's putting all of these people in danger with this ring. And he tells them all, I've got to go and do this alone. And that means leaving his best friend Sam. And there's a scene when he's rowing his boat in a lake to get away from Sam, who's on the shore. And Sam's calling after him, don't you leave me. So Sam jumps in the water and starts swimming, even though he can't swim. He begins to drown. Frodo stops, pulls the boat back, reaches down, pull Sam into the boat. If you remember that scene, then you don't forget this part of the movie. It's so powerful. Sam looks up to him and said, I made a promise, Mr. Frodo, a promise. Don't you leave me. And I won't leave you. It's such a powerful scene. That's what a vow does. A vow calls for the best in us to be lived out. It gives us a reason to live. It gives us a why to live. Friedrich Nietzsche was right. A person with a why can endure anyhow. This is what a vow does. So let's summarize what we've talked about. A vow is powerful because a vow is our commitment to be faithful in advance of receiving blessings. A vow is powerful because a vow calls forth the best within us. But there's one more thought here. And it has to do with living out the vow. What good is a vow if we don't stick to it and if we don't live it out? And what motivates us to live out a vow that we welcome God into? It's because a vow means staying dependent on God. It means staying dependent on God. There are many people in Oberammergau today who can actually trace their lineage back to the families who made the very first vow in 1633. They realize they would not be here today if God had not come through for them. Their lives are a result of that blessing. That's the power of a vow, when we realize everything we have in our lives comes from a God who is gracious and good and has blessed us. How can we ever return that? How can we ever live up to that? It's bigger than us. We simply want to respond out of that sense of gratitude, of being blessed. Some years ago, a friend of mine who was a pastor in England offered this definition for a covenant, which in many ways is like a vow. It welcomes God into the agreement. I exchanged the word vow for covenant because I think this provides for us a really helpful definition of what a vow is. A vow is a promise to God that's made in a moment of strength so that it cannot be broken in a moment of weakness. It's made in a moment of clarity. It's made when we are clear about what we're doing. What was the priest in the temple criticizing Hannah of? That she had been drinking. She was praying with her lips moving, but making no sound. He said, "Woman, get out of here. You've been drinking." She said, "No. I'm as clear-headed right now as I ever have been in my life. I need God." And when we make a commitment to God out of a place of strength, we welcome into our lives a God who never quits on people, a God who never gives up, a God who would never say, "You know, I'm just a little tired looking after you today. I'm going to take a break from it." Never does it. We welcome that help into our lives. And God understands we're people who struggle to be faithful. We're people who have a hard time living up to our vows. But when we commit ourselves to God, that means that we have a commitment that holds firm even when we're weak. And it's never too late to be faithful. It's never too late. As I was working on the message this week, I was thinking about my own life. And I was thinking about when the next Oberammergau Passion Play comes along. I may well be retired when that happens in 2030. God willing, if I live that long, that by the next Passion Play, if I'm not retired, we're probably talking about my retirement. I'm in the fourth quarter now. It's the last quarter of my career. And one thing I'm very aware of is for faith leaders, that's the most dangerous quarter. You look at stories in the Bible, stories like Hezekiah, people who did great things of faith, got to the end of their lives and started relying on their blessings so much that they made careless mistakes. They allowed their vows to slip. Think about church leaders today. Sometimes the fourth quarter is the most dangerous. And I was just thinking, I don't want that to happen to me. I want to go out strong. And I thought, maybe you're somebody who wants to go out strong. You want to continue in faithfulness with the same fire and passion and your love for God inside of you as you had when you were a young person. And you want to live out your years well. In your bulletin this morning, there's a little card that looks like this, and I invite you to take it out. If you would like to renew your vow to be faithful to God, this is a little way to sort of tangibly demonstrate that. On the card is printed the words of the end of the Wesley Covenant Prayer. It says, "I freely, give all that I am and all that I have to you, and now, holy God, you are mine and I am yours. So be it. And if you would desire to, sign your name and put this someplace where you'll see it regularly. Go through this season of Lent being reminded that you want to live out your vows to God with strength. Let us pray. What a powerful thing it is, God, when you take the vows of people and you lend your power and your help and blessing and people respond. History changes. Our lives change. May we be a people who take seriously our commitments and our promises to you, and today renew our commitment to let your help be experienced and expressed in our lives and our faithfulness to all the help you provide to be found true. We come now to this moment of commitment and receiving this very symbol of your pledge to us, your faithfulness, your vow to forgive and to bless. So open our hearts to you as we receive together in Christ's name. Amen. Thank you.